Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, May 18, 2018, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's teleforum conference call. This teleforum will discuss ALDF v. Wasden, the Ninth Circuit and Idaho's ag-gag law. My name is Laura Flint, and I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today we are happy to have with us Professor Eugene Volokh, Gary T. Schwartz Professor of Law at UCLA School of Law, and our moderator, Andrew R. Varco, partner at Boyden Gray & Associates. After hearing from our speakers, we'll go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us, Andrew. The floor is yours.
Thank you. I'm a lawyer in private practice in D.C. I've worked over the years for agribusiness, natural resources, and energy industry clients, and in a past life I was an in-house lawyer at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, where, among other things, I litigated animal welfare cases in the courts of appeals. Professor Volokh is a renowned and prolific First Amendment scholar. He is Gary T. Schwartz Distinguished Professor of Law at the UCLA School of Law. It would take me several minutes to recount all the elements of his resume and accomplishments that are of interest to our listeners. He is, among other things, the author of a standard First Amendment textbook and clerked for Justice Sandra Day O'Connor of the U.S. Supreme Court and for Judge Alex Kaczynski of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, and is the founder and co-author of the very interesting and valuable Volokh Conspiracy blog. The main activity today is for Professor Volokh to talk about the separate opinions in the case and their analyses of the statutory provisions at issue, noting possible implications for litigators, perhaps judges as well as legislators. I will pose a few questions as the discussion proceeds. We'll open up the conversation for Q&A at the end. I'll first give a summary of the case and the opinions. At some level, the case pits interests protected by the First Amendment against property rights and privacy interests. It was decided in early 2018 by a Ninth Circuit panel that included judges Martha McEwen, Richard Tallman, and Carlos Bea. The case involves constitutional challenges to a new Idaho law that makes it a crime to engage in interference with agricultural production. A number of states have enacted or considered enacting similar statutes over the years. Opponents generally call them ag-gag laws. There's been quite a bit of litigation in recent years about a number of these other states' laws. We won't get into those, except perhaps in the Q&A if someone has a comment to offer. The law in Idaho was enacted after a series of events that arose after an animal rights group posted a disturbing, secretly filmed expose of the operation of an Idaho dairy farm on the internet, and that drew national attention, led to a law enforcement investigation, a criminal conviction for animal cruelty, other events. The legislative history of the law discloses a mix of motivations for its passage, including concerns about damage to facilities and operations, security, privacy, but also reputational harms that could be caused by undercover investigations. Shortly after the law was enacted, a number of individuals and non-governmental organizations filed suit in federal district court in Idaho, challenging certain provisions of the statute, particularly as they pertain to misrepresentations. And the district court upheld the challenge, struck down all the provisions that were challenged on First Amendment and equal protection grounds. Idaho appealed, and the Fourth Circuit struck down some of the Ninth Circuit struck down some of the four provisions, but upheld others. So, four provisions at issue. The first, in relevant part, prohibits misrepresentations to enter an agricultural production facility. The panel struck that down 2-1. The panel upheld a second provision that Barr's misrepresentations to obtain records of an agricultural production facility. That was a 3-0 decision. The panel also upheld 3-0 a third provision that, in relevant part, proscribes making misrepresentations to obtain employment with an agricultural production facility, coupled with an intent requirement. And then finally, the panel unanimously struck down a provision that bars knowingly entering an agricultural production facility that's not open to the public and making audio or video recordings of the facility's operations without the owner's consent and without any other legal authorization. So the key disagreement among the members of the panel was about the first prohibition. There was a lengthy partial dissent by Judge Carlos Bea, particularly focusing on the majority's reading of a recent Supreme Court case, United States v. Alvarez, which struck down the Federal Stolen Valor Act, which criminalized false claims about the receipt of military decorations or medals. There are a lot of disagreements between the two opinions about the significance of Alvarez and also the significance of entry to property. So with that overview, I will turn the conversation over to Professor Volokh.
Thanks very much. Yeah, I think that this sets up the dispute on the panel quite well. There are also two other possible positions one could have here. One is basically the plaintiff's position, which is that all of this is constitutionally protected speech or gathering of information. So that they should be free to obtain records of an agricultural production facility by misrepresentation or obtain employment that way. And one thing that they point to as to these provisions is the practices of media organizations, that media organizations sometimes will send somebody in to go to work for some company. But the real motivation being to gather information, whether through surreptitious video recording or through some other means. That was, of course, prominent in the Food Lion case some 20 years ago, which was litigated in the Fourth Circuit. Now, I think that even when this is done by mainstream media organizations, I think that is a punishable fraud. A law like this one indeed should be constitutional to the extent that it prohibits this kind of fraud in getting employment or getting records. Employment being a classic case, you're getting money through a misrepresentation. That is classic punishable fraud. But again, some people take the view that should be a tool that's available both for mainstream media organizations and for undercover actions by advocacy groups, whether one's on the left or one's on the right. The other position, of course, is one that the state took, which is that all of this can be restricted, including the audio and video recording. If you go, even if there is a right to audio video record in public places, when it comes to facilities that are not open to the public, that you should have to get permission before audio video recording there, and the state may make it a crime to record without that kind of permission. I think the difficulty with that position is that this law is a content-based restriction rather than a content-neutral one. Not only does it target agricultural production facilities, which it probably can do without being content-based, at least under existing precedent, but it is limited to recordings of the conduct of the agricultural production facilities operations, and that, as the panel unanimously concluded, was a content-based restriction. You can go on the property to record all sorts of things, and that's fine, but if you want to record the conduct of the agricultural production facilities operations, that is illegal. And in fact, as a practical matter, agricultural production facilities are defined broadly enough to include, for example, many supermarkets because they package agricultural products there. So indeed, a lot of what you'd be recording at a supermarket surreptitiously might not be covered by the law, but the operations of the agricultural production facility, part of the supermarket, would be covered. So that kind of content discrimination is unconstitutional. That's kind of a technical point, although a very important First Amendment point. It suggests that, in fact, it might be the case that the legislature could reinstitute this ban if it only makes it broader. So perhaps at some point we'll be seeing attempts to do that. Note, though, as a practical matter, that there are political constraints on broader laws. In fact, one rationale for the court's content discrimination program doctrine is that you want to make sure that the legislature does indeed, if it wants to apply the law to protect privacy or protect other values, that it does indeed do it in a content-neutral way, so that lots of groups will feel its sting, and that if the legislature actually enacts it, despite this political opposition, that is a sign that there really is a strong argument for it. So in any event, those are the possible positions out there. I think on balance, Judge Bay's dissent would probably took the better view, but in any event, the majority or the unanimous panel was, I think, correct as to the obtaining records provision, obtaining employment provision, which it upheld, and the video recording provision that it struck down.
So I have a few questions. What's your thinking on the role that legislative motive plays in the majority opinion? The majority seems to give some weight to the statements of individual legislators. And in the course of its lengthy opinion, cites some opinions that seem to support doing that, but they are individual legislators, and there was, I think the majority says in a number of occasions, there are mixed motives. There are a number of motives that animated the legislators. How much difference did that make? How much difference should it make? If you're a legislator, are there certain things you should stop saying or start saying if you want to enact laws like this?
Well, generally speaking, the views of particular legislators are not supposed to matter much when it comes to speech restrictions. It's a different matter as to equal protection challenges, alleged race discrimination, sex discrimination, and the like. But under the O'Brien case, the draft card burning case, the court's view was that statements of individual legislators are not that significant. And to the extent that we care about the motivation of the legislature as a body, that is best reflected, determined from the face of the statute, rather than through statements of particular people who may not represent what the majority of the legislatures thought. That's never been a completely rigid rule, but in this instance, what the court says is, look, there were these statements that should require us to look closely at whether, in fact, the law is a good fit to its asserted content-neutral purposes, and when it comes to at least those parts that the majority upheld, they said, yeah, that's fine. So it didn't give that much weight to the statements of individual legislators. And I think that makes sense because some legislators might, for example, express hostility to particular speech, but other legislators might have speech neutral motives, or in fact, many legislators might have a mix of those motives. So I don't think that the panel really relied heavily on the statements of individual legislators, though it did mention them ultimately. It ultimately held certain portions of the law on the grounds that they had an adequate content neutral justification.
And the majority, speaking specifically about the misrepresentation prong of the first provision, the provision about entry to property on which Judge Bea dissented, it was also concerned not only by, in part, by the intent to target speech and investigative journalists, but also about the provisions criminalizing innocent behavior and being liable to staggering overbreadth. And that relates to a fairly lengthy discussion of hypotheticals, including elaborate hypothetical about a teenager who is the son or child of a restaurant reviewer, a journalist who goes into a restaurant, and Judge Bea doesn't see that hypothetical the same way. And I guess, what are your thoughts about the sort of overbreadth issue, and then also about this interesting hypothetical?
In order to focus on that, we need to step back a bit and go back several years to Alvarez, the Stolen Valor Act case. And the question there was, is there a First Amendment exception for basically knowing lies? Or are there a bunch of narrow First Amendment exceptions, one for fraud, one for libel, one for perjury? I had thought, and I actually filed a brief in that case, so arguing that there is a First Amendment exception for knowing lies, false statement of lack constitutional value, says the Supreme Court in Gertz v. Robert Welch, and setting aside things like alleged lies about history or about science or about the government, situations where it's particularly dangerous to let the government adjudicate such things, where you're talking about lies about more specific matters such as did you or did you not get a particular military decoration, then that speech is unprotected. But the majority said, or actually the plurality said, look, there is no First Amendment exception for lies. Again, there are specific exceptions for fraud, libel, perjury, and the like, and maybe some other restrictions could be upheld under strict scrutiny restrictions. The fact that something is a knowing lie outside of those categories does not diminish its First Amendment protection. And then the concurrence, Justice Kagan said, well, knowing lies are subject to less protection, subject only to intermediate scrutiny rather than strict scrutiny, but not no protection. So we've got a complicated doctrine out there, but that has led to the conclusion that certain kinds of lies indeed are protected. If you think that lies are just constitutionally valueless and therefore unprotected, then buying arguments about supposed overbreadth of the law might be quite broad in that it covers a lot of lies, including ones you might think maybe shouldn't be criminalized, but it wouldn't be overbroad because, by your hypothesis, lies aren't constitutionally protected. So therefore, the overbreadth doctrine, which kicks in only when the law restricts a substantial amount of constitutionally protected speech, wouldn't kick in. That's a plausible view. That was my view, I suppose. Is my view as to the better view of the First Amendment. But that's not the Supreme Court's view. So the Supreme Court says, a lot of kind of day-to-day lies about your accomplishments, lies about who you are, are not constitutionally unprotected. Positively, are constitutionally protected, although maybe a little less protected than statement in the judgment of the concurrence, for example. This does suggest certain kinds of lies aimed at gaining access to property might indeed fall in this category of constitutionally protected, let's call them everyday fibs. It's sort of the notion behind Roberts and Kagan's concurrence in Alvarez that, look, people lie about all sorts of things, and it can't be that all those lies are unprotected. Therefore, we should protect them unless they're lying about getting something tangible, because everybody agrees with the fraud exception, which is lies about getting some benefits, lies aimed at getting some benefits. Once Alvarez concludes that these kinds of constitutionally protected fibs these kinds of fibs are constitutionally protected, there is a large zone of them, then in that case, the panel majority's position becomes more plausible. You lie in order to get into a fancy restaurant that you otherwise wouldn't get into. You're willing to pay the money, you're not stealing them, but you are sure it can't be made a crime. Whereas the defense is, well, why can't it be? You may not be lying in order to get money, but you're lying in order to get access to somebody else's property, whether it's an agricultural action through the traditional sense, or a restaurant that might be covered under this broad definition. If you lie in order to get a reservation that you otherwise wouldn't be given, you're still getting something that's tangibly valuable, access to this property, and the restaurant may be losing something that's tangibly valuable, which is the right to control who gets access to its property. That is a right that has long been secured by American trespass law. So it's a subtle matter, but potentially an important one, and one that fits into this debate at the heart of Alvarez, which is how bad a lie does it have to be? How much is it that you're trying to get punishable fraud and stops it from being a protected kind of little fib?
Andy, do you have any more questions for Professor Volokh, or should we go to audience questions?
I think we should.
Or answers. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this.
Well, I am not the author of any First Amendment textbooks.
But you have experience and knowledge and views.
I have experience and knowledge and views. So my intuitive thought is that probably Judge Bea is right. I have had occasion in the past to advise government affairs professionals who are often very concerned about trying to get laws passed or stop getting laws passed. And so to some extent, I think about these issues from the lens of trying to provide practical advice to people who want to achieve business and policy goals and often want clear answers. I think the majority opinion in some ways to somebody like that is a little frustrating. It's a little unclear what to take away. But at the same time, there are statements in the majority opinion that provide a fair amount of guidance as to what not to do. And after all, much of the statute was upheld at the end of the day. So those are some of my thoughts.
Let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. I don't see any questions from the audience right now. So, Andy, do you have anything that you'd like to add?
Yeah, so following on what Professor Volokh was just discussing, there's a disagreement, fundamental disagreement with the majority dissent about the value of entry to property and relatedly about the significance, I think, of Idaho's existing prohibition on trespass. There's a passage in the majority opinion that says that even assuming Idaho has a compelling interest in regulating property rights and protecting its farm industry, criminalizing access to property by misrepresentation is not actually necessary to protect those rights. If, as Idaho argues, its real concern is trespass, then Idaho already has a prohibition against trespass that does not implicate speech in any way. So is that right? Is that persuasive? And then a sort of second question, what does it really matter anyway if there's a prohibition against trespass? What's the fight about?
Well, my sense is that laws that trespass, generally speaking, have pretty much, especially in practice, and those aren't really enough to deter a lot of would-be trespassers. So either this law poses greater punishments, or in any event, in order to deter this kind of behavior, there would need to be greater punishments under existing laws than there are as a practical matter. So I wasn't persuaded by that aspect of the court's opinion, that even if there is such a law that is in Idaho that would cover all of this kind of behavior and impose meaningful punishments on it, if the only time serious punishments are imposed is when somebody is entering this agricultural production facility, then in that case, that practice can be challenged on the same grounds that this law is being challenged. So what I think the court is really saying is that as a practical matter, this kind of what it sees as a fib, a lie that doesn't cause much harm, really would be protected at least against criminal punishment. Although, of course, lies aimed at getting records or getting employment are a different matter.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. I'll make a brief announcement while we wait for our first audience question. Our next Teleform conference call is scheduled for Monday, May 21st. That call will be on the case for political appointment of judges and will feature Professor Brian T. Fitzpatrick, Professor of Law at Vanderbilt University School of Law, and Professor Stephen J. Ware, Professor of Law at University of Kansas School of Law. Let's go to our first audience question.
Hi, this is Teresa Collette in Minnesota. How much, if at all, do you think the Ninth Circuit was influenced by the fact that it has had and there is still pending litigation in the California courts regarding the undercover videos of Planned Parenthood that allegedly show they were engaged in removing fetal organs from aborted babies, as well as altering the method of abortion in order to facilitate the transfer of those organs to various research institutions and other potential recipients?
So I think that this highlights an important question at the heart of a lot of these discussions about audio and video recording, even though it's rarely talked about. There have been a bunch of cases, about half a dozen circuit court cases in recent years, that have said, yes, there is a right to audio and video record, even surreptitiously audio and video record, because that's really important for your future speech. If you're going to credibly complain about, for example, alleged police misconduct, you need to have the goods. You need to have proof in the form of audio and video recording. Therefore, a restriction on that kind of audio-video recording is not itself a restriction on speech as such, but it's a restriction on information gathering. Well, all right, but what about the laws in about a dozen states, including California, that criminalize audio recording of confidential communications, of conversations that basically the parties don't expect to be recorded and transmitted further. These are seen by many as important protections to privacy. Others disagree. I have two minds about them. But if one really reads the circuit decisions about the value of information gathering to their logical extent, in that case, those laws would be unconstitutional, because after all, if you're having a private conversation with someone, you think you may be saying something incriminating about an important public issue. Well, you'd want to be able to record that, and yet the laws don't allow you to do that. And it is laws like that are in large measure part of this debate about the surreptitious gathering of information about abortion providers. Of course, it's also possible to read the circuit decisions more narrowly to say that, well, it's one thing if you're in a public place, especially recording a public official like a police officer, but maybe even recording what other people are doing in a public place. Fine, but if you're in a private place, recording things that people are expecting would be private and reasonably expecting would be private, like a private conversation you're having with them, that's impermissible. So it's an interesting question which the cases have not yet had to resolve. One way in which the Ninth Circuit gets to duck this question in this instance is because this law is specifically focused on gathering one very particular subject matter information. Excuse me. And that is the operations of agricultural facilities. It's right there in the statute that it's limited to recording of those operations. And the court doesn't tell us what would happen if the law were content neutral. It applied. So all recordings in place is not open to the public. So we don't know, and therefore we don't know how, for example, would adapt. One thing this put me in mind of is there was this debate about residential picketing in the 1980s. Early in the decade, it struck down ban on residential picketing. It was kind of debate because it excluded labor picketing. And the court said, look, we don't have to decide if residential picketing is generally protected by the First Amendment because we know restriction. Then later in the decade, the court upheld a broad ban, a content-neutral ban on residential picketing, saying, well, all we decided in the early case was the content-based ban is unconstitutional. Content-neutral bans are fine. So it may be that if a general content-neutral or at least content-neutral restriction on recording communications comes before the court will say, well, that's different because it's content-neutral.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. A reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming Teleforum calls and to consult the full schedule of our upcoming calls on the Federalist Society's website, fedsoc.org. Also available there are podcasts of previously recorded Teleforum calls you may have missed. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any. Andy, do you have any more questions?
Yes, one, and a further thought about Professor Collette's question. Quite a few amicus briefs were filed in the Ninth Circuit by, it looks like, at least one industry group and a union, quite a few First Amendment groups and scholars and food policy kinds of groups, but I don't see at least just looking at the opinion, that any group on either side of pro-life or pro-choice debates filed a brief. I guess my probably my final question is, how should a lawyer advise a legislator, if you're a lawyer in some legislative office in Idaho or elsewhere, who's getting asked by constituents to pass laws like this? As the opinion in this case notes, there were some threats to the dairy farm owner and his family after the national attention that arose from the video. What kinds of pointers would you give such a lawyer, the in-house lawyer in the Idaho legislature or something like that?
Well, one is focus on non-communicative harms rather than harms that flow from communication. That, sure, people don't like to be criticized, don't like to be criticized in ways that they think are unfair, and, of course, don't like to be criticized in ways that might lead some who listen to the criticism to actually engage in violence or submit threats. These are not permissible bases, generally, for broad restrictions on speech. You can ban libel, you can ban the threats, you can ban incitement of likely and imminent, intentional, likely imminent lawless conduct, but you can't restrict speech just because you think that speech or the conduct will lead to speech that will be unfair or will be harmful to business. Instead, you can focus on things that may actually be less important in some people's minds but are legitimate basis for restriction, such as fraud, lying in order to get money, lying in order to get records. Possibly, rely and, or at least work off of Judge Bay's dissent and say, well, we think that lying in order to get access to property is also not because it harms people's reputations or leads to unfair criticism, but because it interferes with their property rights in ways quite apart from the communicative impact of whatever people gather. So focus on the injury to property rights, focus on the fraud, and don't focus on the worry that, or however reasonable the worry may be, that the conduct will lead to speech that will then be bad for business, or even perhaps may indirectly lead to threats. Second thing is, make the law content neutral. You recognize that may make for a broader law, and then make sure that you've got the political support for the broader law. So have a law that says you can't audio or video record on property that's close to the public, period, rather than just you can't audio or video record agricultural processing operations. And then finally, as to the trespass, perhaps if you could, it's possible you make specific findings in the law in the statute about the common law of the state, long protecting the right to control who accesses one's property as an important tangible interest. You know, you can imagine another circuit that kind of helping judges focus on the arguments made by Judge Bay in his dissent. Although I'm not sure how much these kinds of findings ultimately will help. So I think there is, as you pointed out, there is lots of opportunity for state legislature to enact some such laws in order to protect legitimate property interests. They don't have an unlimited free hand.
I think that's very helpful. I would just note for the listeners that this is a live issue, number of pending suits. Utah's law was struck down by a federal district court last year. Utah did not appeal that decision. Iowa has a law criminalizing agricultural production facility fraud, and there's a challenge to that law pending in the Southern District of Iowa. The Fourth Circuit heard argument in a challenge to a North Carolina statute about removing documents from an employer's premises and recording images or sound on the employer's premises. The Court of Appeals heard argument and challenged to that law early this year. It had been dismissed by district court on standing grounds. And then there's a Wyoming law that's already been up to the Tenth Circuit and somewhat different, but related in some ways. And so perhaps we'll have you back, Professor Volokh, before long to talk about other matters. But thank you very much for the benefit of your expertise.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.